I have clicked record, Brad.
We are recording over here in Philadelphia as well. And Dave, I'm afraid we have some bad news for the Webcomics Weekly listenership today.
Bad news indeed. We have a full roster of all four Half Pixel members. If you don't take into account the fact that Scott and Chris couldn't make it tonight,
that's right.
So that means there's only two of us. It's the Geiger Kellett Power Hour.
That's right. You've got half of Half Pixel.
It's back to Brad and I, back when we used to sell shoe polish door to door in the mid 90s. We're back to doing that old routine again.
That old guy. Oh,
it's like the old times, Brad. They all come rushing back, don't they?
Oh yes, especially the fumes we used to huff around back of the garage when the shoe polish wasn't selling all that well.
Why do some products get associated with the term huff? Like glue is always huffed.
Yep.
And shoe polish is always huffed. I mean, what is huff as a word? Hold on, I want to look that up. Dictionary.com, here I come. And you're not talking while I'm typing.
No, you know, I'm trying to make a Big Bad Wolf reference there, and nothing's coming. Because he huffed and puffed.
The
Big Bad Wolf actually had a glue and a marijuana addiction because he huffed and puffed.
Oh, boo. Boo, Brad Geiger, boo. Well, you know what's funny?
I need
OED, because the OED is the only dictionary that tells you how a word got started. I need to know how huff got started. That's the problem. Huff sounds like, because you can throw a huff, right? But then you can also huff glue.
You can leave in a huff, and if you don't have time, you can leave in a minute and a huff. That's an old joke. That's an old Groucho Marx joke.
I know, and it earned the laughter that it got from me.
Who was the woman that he used to be the foil for his stuff? Margaret, was it Duchamp or Dumont? The big heavyset woman, Margaret Dumont, I think. He would constantly throw these lines at her like, "Oh, you can leave in a half, you can leave in a half, or you can leave in a minute and a half." Whoa, Colonel Spaulding.
So there's 10 definitions for huff. One is a mood of sulking anger, a fit of resentment. Just because you disagree, don't walk off in a huff. So that's a noun. Then you can also verb it, where you can give offense or make angry. I don't know how you would give offense with a huff. He huffed me? Or I huffed him? How would you verbalize that? To treat with arrogance or contempt, to hector or bully. Quit being so huffy, I guess is the way to say that, yeah? Oh, in checkers, to remove a piece from the board as a penalty for failing to make compulsory capture is a huff. And then
really?
Slang, to inhale the vapors in order to become intoxicated, to huff glue.
And
well, we've learned a lot today on Webcomics Weekly.
So does it say where it started?
It doesn't. Oh, wait, you know what it does? The origin is from 1575 to 1585 as a derivation of puff.
Well,
which would make sense if the verb is to puff or blow or breathe heavily or something, you know.
I guess. And to think we got started.
But you know what?
On...
You know what? Actually, this raises a good point, because I don't know if I've ever talked about this on Webcomics Weekly. But,
oh, good Lord.
Would you agree, Brad, that half of cartooning, more than half of cartooning, is in the writing?
Oh, yeah.
In terms of the wordplay. So, because I've known you to do this, is that if you hear a strange word. Like, even in the car ride that we took the other day to Webcomics Weekend, I remember somebody in the car said a weird word, and I heard you in the front seat rolling the word around in your brain. You kept saying it and trying to figure out a joke applying to that word.
Yeah, you know what?
And,
it's true.
But I think that's an intrinsic quality to writers and to cartoonists, don't you think, is a love for wordcraft and for, quite honestly, messing with words.
Yeah, you've got to – I think that's true, and I noticed that a lot. When I was hanging out at just like you, you've kind of got to have a fascination with the English language and the mechanics behind the English language, and deeper still, how the English language affects logic and how logic affects the English language. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I do know how you mean.
Really,
how the language that you speak affects
thinking.
The way that you think.
Yeah, yeah, and every now and again. You know, somebody would say something and another person would remark not on how funny it was, but on the joke construction. And I thought a couple times out there in Northampton, only in this crowd would you you know, slap down a funny or moderately funny line, and the reaction wouldn't be ha ha ha. But you know, I like how you constructed that, or even to give an idea of another way to construct it, and not in a mean way, not like oh that wasn't funny. But what you find a lot of times is people doing the yes and thing, where they're like oh yeah, or you could do it this way, and then everybody kind of starts putting their own constructions onto the joke, and really what they're doing is just turning that language around in their head over and over again and finding different angles and make seeing if they can make it work a different way.
Yeah, and it's not unlike how, you know, when you're a kid and you're 12 and you're playing baseball and the coach just has you throw the ball back and forth to warm up for an hour, is that you see all the different ways that you can throw a ball with your hand. If you crack your wrist this way, if you break at the shoulder, if you break at the elbow, you know what I mean? All the different ways that you can throw a baseball. And I think partially what cartoonists are doing when they sit around and do stuff like that is, like, you're teaching one another all the different ways that you can break and reform and reshape the English language, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It is fascinating to listen to cartoonists talk, particularly when they're relaxed and joking around and stuff. And really listening how they use the language, because we're always constructing jokes and we're always kind of editing ourselves midway through the sentence and starting it again because we realize halfway through that there's a better way to build that sentence. Have you noticed that happen?
All the time.
Almost like a stammering thing that they'll start and then stop and then start again because they've figured out that there's a better way to build those words so that their joke is going to be funnier, you know?
Yeah, it's one of the things that I'm really thankful to my dad for is the gift that he gave me. And this is going to sound so silly, but it's made a big impact on how I write, which is when I was a kid growing up, when one of my older brothers or sisters would use a word and I would say, "Dad, what does that word mean?" And every time consistently he would say, "Go to the dictionary, look it up." And I would always look it up. And just the same thing we just did right now with Huff is you learn all the different possibilities. And what that teaches you is all the gray areas of language, not just that Huff means to snort glue, but or not snort glue necessarily, but to breathe in glue. But it also teaches you that if you ever need to use the word Huff, here are all the other derivations and possible uses that you can intentionally misuse, you know?
Right, right. So in other words, what you're doing is building up Huff. You just learned Huff as a word, and you've learned that there are different ways that you can use Huff as a misdirection in the setup of a joke to make them think you're going one way with Huff when really you're going the other way. And that really gets to the building block of building a joke. Because now you're talking misdirection. And misdirection is gosh, wouldn't you say 80% of the humor that's written?
Oh, yeah. I mean, aside from violence, whether it's, your basic slapstick or verbal violence in terms of somebody winning out over another is sort of the base of humor. And then there's the sort of, the fart jokes, which are the sort of the next level up. And then, you know, everything else in terms of higher joke construction is in some way a form of misdirection. You're probably right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a good chunk of it that's misdirection. I can think of exceptions, but yeah, you're right. Yeah, but yeah, that love of language, I think, is a big part of being a cartoonist. And I think it's interesting, too, that cartoonists like Sergio Aragonés, who when he came from Mexico, who didn't maybe have as masterful a command of the English language as he would have wanted back then, it's probably very telling that what he started to do for Mad is the very pantomime physical strip.
Right,
you know?
Right. Dave, do you have Sheldon translated into different languages?
It's been translated into very limited into Mandarin, somewhat extensively into Norwegian, and smatterings into German. How about you with Evil Inc.?
I've been approached at different times, you know, about getting the rights to translate it into Spanish and so forth, and I never do it because I can't imagine that the joke construction and the humor that works in English would work in another language. Especially because there's a lot of stuff that I do that's based on puns, you know?
Yeah, you're right. And what I'm always afraid of is there's just enough of this in Sheldon where I'm like, well, this is never going to work. If I make an IHOP joke or a Denny's joke or, you know, name any other pop culture or American culture thing you could imagine, how the heck is that going to translate into Norwegian, you know?
Right. Well, that's just it.
There's no way that's going to work.
It's popped up about three or four times where somebody wants to. Well, it goes beyond the language. The other thing is that they want, you know, they don't want to pay anything for it. They're like, oh, and we're gonna send them right to your site. It's like, no. what you're looking for is a cheap and easy way to, you know, all you got to do is translate, and you've got a comic strip of your own to run, you know. But
yeah, and the other half of your brain is thinking, you know what I need more at Evil Inc. is those ten readers from Madrid or Sevilla you're gonna send my way. Thanks
right,
a lot, champ.
Right.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
And who, you know, exactly, if they're reading it in Spanish, they're not going to go to the English language website to all of a sudden start trying to translate. You know, what good is somebody who doesn't read English to me? I guess that maybe that makes me sound close-minded, but at the end of the day, what good is somebody who doesn't read English to me?
No, but I like the way you make that sound like you're dead to me. Like,
no, no, no,
me?
I don't
you
mean that in
me.
That way. I mean, they're, I'm
no,
sure,
no, I know.
I'm sure they're very nice people. but in terms of what I'm doing, there's no need, there's no use. Even if I were to say, there, maybe perceive a value in someone translating Evil Inc. into Spanish, let's say that takes root and people start reading it in Spanish. And now what? Unless I start sending those guys high-res strips, and they start doing the translations in high-res, and I with an eye towards building books in Spanish and starting publishing in Spanish and I almost said Spanish and American, Spanish and English, where does that go? I don't know where that builds out, you know. And there's so much of my strip that, like yours, relies so heavily on American culture that I don't know that it would be of any use. I think the same thing that a non-English speaking person would say, what good is Evil Inc. to me?
Yeah, it's really, it's such a diminished return that it's almost negligible. Because even if you, let's say you build an audience of 10,000 Spanish speakers in say Mexico or Spain that love Evil Inc., well, aside from maybe an invitation to a Mexican or Spanish comics convention, mm-hmm. which wouldn't necessarily gain you much anyway, you're right. Unless there's a printing opportunity at the end,
right?
There's at the end of that rainbow, there's really no purpose at all to it, to going in. Aside from the small ego boost that you might feel of, hey, I'm the 7,000th most popular site on a Spanish comics translation web page, you know.
Yeah, I don't get. I
can I tell you the only title that I've ever been involved with where I wanted to bring it to another culture was How to Make Web Comics.
Oh,
the one that I want. I still want to get that translated into French, and this for the dumbest of reasons.
You
want
to get invited to Angoulême? What's that one? Angoulême?
Angoulême. Yeah, that's the only reason why I want to do it. I just want to get Half Pixel invited to Angoulême. That's the only stupid reason why I want to do it.
I don't think that's such a stupid reason at all.
Well, it is in the sense of, like, you know, I should be doing it because I want to see the book in French. Well, who cares? I don't really care. But I just want the free trip to France. I just want to get invited to Angoulême.
That's a great idea. Yeah, we really do have to look at that sometime and getting that translated. The first step, I mean, really, you could do an automatic translating. But I can't imagine that would, if you did like software that translated automatically, I couldn't imagine that it would be very good, but it might get you ballpark that you could actually get somebody who has basic French skills to clean it up.
Yeah. Well, here's a question for you from two ignorant Americans of the French market. How much of How to Make Web Comics would even be applicable to the French style of comics, do you think, in terms of that long form, super colorful, beautiful bande dessinée? That requires, you know, really beautiful five-color, six-color hexachrome printing. Would our model work? Because that seems to require a business system that produces beautiful, lush pages that come out.
Yeah, but listen, you talk hexachrome printing, blah blah blah, blah pages. That's not web comics. You know, I think here's two things that I think about that. Number one. I maintain very, very strongly that everything we put in that book, even though the four of us are strip authors, everything we put in that book is very directly translatable to people who are doing long-form comics on the web. You know what I mean? It doesn't take that much of a strip, or it doesn't take that much of a stretch, rather, to go from what we're saying about strips and applying that to putting a long-form comic on the web. It's still the same thing.
No,
you're right. You still have to update frequently and consistently. You still have to make sure that every update is significant and satisfying to your reader. And that's basically what we're saying about the strips. And it completely translates into long form. So I would say that if there's one of those French authors that want to do their comic on the web, that our book would be very applicable to them. And the other thing is, obviously, if they want to be doing web comics, I got to figure the rules are the same for them as it is for everybody else on the World Wide Web. The long and short of it is people do want frequent and consistent updates. And people will not stick around for three pages of somebody falling down the well over the course of a week and a half. It's the same rules that we see over and over again in not only web comics, but a lot of web publishing, whether it be blogs or any other kind of site you can mention. Those things
Before you go further along, I agree with you completely. I guess what I meant was not so much the web part of it, but the French daily life or the French traditional interaction with comics that doesn't relate to the web. And by that I mean, like, a lot of what we propose for how to make web comics is applicable because some of the traditional systems are completely breaking down, you know?
Right.
And I guess my question was, how do we even know that how the French market is doing and how is it faring and all that sort of stuff? But you're right. Of course, obviously, all the sort of stuff that we've talked about before in terms of long form working online, in terms of the satisfying update and all that sort of stuff, that is applicable no matter what language you're in. However, I would say this: it would be funny to see a French webcomic, because you know how in in English speaking webcomics, that when somebody doesn't update, they're always like, "Hey guys, so sorry. Big problems today at the house. Couldn't do a comic today." In France, it would be like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I had to go out and get more cigarettes. My apologies. The local store ran out." That's my terrible French accent. You were giving me no love on it, so I had to stop it. I had to stop it completely.
No, I was sitting just in amazement how you were, because I knew you were going that way, and I wanted to see where it was going to go.
So this is a curious question. Where did you think I was going to go with the French joke?
I thought you were going sex. I think at some point he was going to stop for cigarettes and find a woman with long raven hair and blue eyes and have a tryst out in the park. But maybe that's just where I wanted it to go deep in my heart.
I'm so sorry I couldn't update today. I had to update today for the meal.
Do you think French people ever do that whole thing? You know, they do that. I had to update, if you know what I mean.
At what point
does my French accent turn into Count Dracula?
About 2 seconds in, usually. But somebody, I heard somebody remark one time that a culture jokes about what it's most uncomfortable with. So with American culture, it's usually about sex or some version of sex.
Really?
And with the French humor often revolves around religion, because that's what they're most uncomfortable about talking about publicly.
Really?
Not sex, which is, you know, it's not uncommon for people to talk about the mistress of the president in public and that sort of stuff. But it's actually religion in French culture. I thought that was interesting, and it explains why we will never break into Angoulême, because how many of us are making uncomfortable religion jokes in Evil Inc. or Sheldon?
Oh God, as seldom as possible.
Well, you know, okay, so that was a nice actual rat hole that we did not intend, but we actually have some questions to get into. Shall we dive into those, my friend?
Yeah, you've got the first one, I think. Yeah, sitting right there in front of you.
Yeah, I do. So this came from one of the best names I've ever seen. Mishy Sherlock sends in a question there. Hey there, Half Pixel Crew.
I want to hear it as the taxi driver.
As a taxi driver? All right, here we go. Hey! Hey there, Half Pixel Crew! Hey, I'm a big fan of the podcast and all your work in webcomics. You guys rock! Hey! I'm a college student living in Montreal, Quebec. Now it's not working. It doesn't work because she's a college student living in Montreal, Quebec.
Go back to the French. Go back to the French.
Now I've got to switch to a Québécois. I can't do Québécois. Okay, so I'm a college student living in Montreal, Quebec. This is a long question, so I'm going to read it quickly.
Okay.
And one of my professors is giving a class on graphic novels. However, after talking with him the other day, he seems to think that comics, even though they're a cool medium, have no validity in the academic world. So here's my question. Do you think that comics in print will ever be treated seriously by academics? And do you think web comics will ever get to the point where they will be studied seriously? Also, does it matter to you what academia has to say about comics, web comics? I know you've already talked about critics' reviews of your comics, but I'm talking about, say, articles in academic journals like the Journal of Popular Culture or the more recently established Image Text magazine put out by the University of Florida, which, despite it being entirely about comics, has never run an article about a webcomic. As an aspiring comics artist, writer, but also a bookish English major, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks for your time. Mishy Sherlock, which is the best name ever, by the way, Mishy. That is a fantastic name, Mishy.
Well, Mishy. So,
Brad, you want to dive in on that one first?
Do I ever think that comics will be taken seriously by academia? And I can say with an emphatic, I sure hope not. Can you imagine? Have you ever had an enjoyable experience reading something that was taken seriously by academia? If comics start getting taken seriously by academia, it means that comics have gone down the wrong path and are headed for death. I want comics to stay just the way they are, on the fringe of popular culture, right out there where they belong, where the really cool and hip people know how to find them. I do not want them to be serious, taken seriously, debated seriously. I want comics to be what they are, fun entertainment for people who, for the masses, quite frankly. I know that makes them sound like they're... meatloaf instead of steak, but I want comics to be exactly what they are. I don't ever want them to see. I don't ever want to see these literary journals delving into web comics, because it means that the web comics that they're delving into must be dreadfully boring.
Well, you're okay. So I disagree with you, but I think that there's something to be said for the spirit of what you're saying, which is like. What's that old line that if a joke is like a frog and if you try to dissect it, it does no good for either party? Or
that's
what was that line?
That's an E.B. White quote, and you got it absolutely right. Dissecting humor is like, explaining humor is like dissecting a frog. It doesn't do you much good, and the frog dies.
Right. So I see where you're going with that, which is the sense that, look, this is for the popular culture, and if you start to take it into academia, you lose sort of the magic of it. You probably knew when you said that I was going to disagree with you, that it doesn't warrant a study or interest.
Well, I knew that I was speaking to somebody who has 2 master's degree in the art and history of cartooning.
Yeah, but, you know, that being said, listen, I'm not so egotistical as to think those master's degrees amount to more than a hill of beans in terms of application to the real world. I wanted them solely for, as a cartoonist, my path, it helped me to look at it from an intellectual standpoint as well as a creative standpoint, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think my mind needed to understand it through an academic setting, as well as through a reader's standing and a creator's standing. And, you know, it's not for everybody, but I certainly benefited from it.
So now tell me why you have your position on
Shakespeare, when he was going, you can't argue that he was anything but a popular art. It was not for the intelligentsia. There was – the groundlings were paying, what, a half penny and throwing frickin' oranges at the actors and grapes – or not grapes, little peanuts at the actors when they came on stage. So, it's, you know, we
sounds
treat
like
Shakespeare
web comics
with the
to
utmost
me.
Of – what's that?
Sounds like web comics to me.
No, but I mean we treat Shakespeare now with the reverence of you know, almost a demigod of the arts. But a lot of that is just time's passage, in the sense that I can imagine we will look back on the creation of, say, Superman as being very evident of what America saw itself as. You know, so for example, superhero comics say a lot about what Americans are versus, say, bande dessinée says a lot about what the French are versus what manga says about what the Japanese are. So there's definitely areas for study. But I see what you're saying, though, in terms of the fun and the joy of it is gone. But from a popular cultural standpoint, you know, even pop culture art has value in an academic world.
Of course.
Trying to figure out who and what we are and what it says about us.
Of course, I know it has value, and of course you know it has value. But if academia never comes around to seeing that it has that value, I couldn't care less.
Oh, I see what you're saying. As far as validating the joy of the art itself,
I don't need.
Like
yes, you know what? You've used the correct word. I don't need academia to validate how I feel about comics and how my readers feel about comics. I just, you know what it is? I see this professor standing up in front of his classroom, looking down his nose, saying, "Well, of course you know. Comics will never be accepted by academia. They certainly don't rise to the merit, blah, blah." And you know what? Screw him. The bottom line is, I don't need your validation for what I'm doing. And if academia never comes around to seeing the beauty, the joy, the passion, the tremendous effort that is comics and web comics, it's not going to affect my day.
Well, you know, you're right, and here's where I think the prejudice of academia comes in. The academic world is almost entirely based upon the written word. You know that old phrase of publish or perish.
Right.
They have to produce constant articles, journal postings, books, novels, in order to maintain or to work towards, not maintain, but to work towards tenure. So the written world is sort of the penultimate or ultimate value in the academic world. And so that's why, even though film got started in the U.S. around, 1910, 1920? Mm-hmm. Help me out there. I don't remember the actual
date. You're in the right neighborhood.
When did film studies start to come in? It wasn't until the 50s or 60s or maybe even the 60s or 70s that it started to work its way into academia.
Well into
and
the
And I
60s,
think largely
yeah.
that's because there was a whole vocabulary in the academic world that was missing on how to study images, especially moving images. And comics fall into that same trap in that these are people that are not trained to value or find academic interest in an image.
Mm-hmm.
And comics are more than just a written word. They're the melding. There's the synthesis of the image and the written word becoming something I think that's even larger than both of them individually. So is there power there? I think undoubtedly there's power there, but I think the academic world isn't structured to value it for the most part.
Yeah, and really it's too bad because they're missing out. I feel it to an extent. I feel bad about an academic that's standing up in front of his class kind of looking down his nose at comics and saying how they'll never be accepted. I think that really if people who had that kind of attitude took a little bit open-minded stance at this, they'd find some really fascinating things to delve into and some really worthwhile pursuits. But
yeah. Well, and even you know, you're right. And just to continue my thought from earlier too, is that when I did my master's degrees, when I did my first one at UCSD, you know, what you tell me, what department was the best one suited for me to study cartoons in a graduate setting? Where would you have done it?
Well, I'll tell you what, the obvious answer would be graphic design, but I'll bet you went through English language.
Yeah, I ended up going through literature to study it.
Yeah.
And you can see the faults there. And had I gone through graphic design, you could see the faults there as well, or through the art department.
Right.
In that they're not structured necessarily to focus on the written word. It's sort of a structural problem in the sense that comics don't really fit into whatever niche the academic world has set up for it. But anyway, I think we've said enough on that. The bottom line, too, is that for professors who have enough trouble finding a date, you know, being seen carrying around a collection of Spider-Woman, the most recent edition, is not going to help. Let's be honest about that. So they're looking for their James Joyce to help them get a date, not so much Spider-Woman.
Yes, spandex and tweed, not a good mix.
That's the best summary ever. Okay, so you had the next question.
So I'll tell you what, we're about at the midpoint, and I don't want to go too much further without us mentioning, and we're going to mention this at the end too for people, we've got a really big weekend coming up, and we got to make sure we talk about it for a second, and that is, as you know, Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle, Washington, Hey-o. This weekend. It's at the Washington Convention Center. Is that right?
Yes, it's April 4th and 5th, and we are at booth. It's almost you can't even miss us. Booth 202. Right up front as you walk in the door. It's in the first row as you walk in the
door. You walk in through registration, take a left, and we're right there.
I think Penny Arcade is on one side of us, and if I'm not mistaken, Marvel is on the other side of us. So we're in we're in good company.
We're in very good company.
But let me tell you, one of those three companies is going bankrupt, and it ain't Penny Arcade, and it ain't Half Pixel.
You can bet your boots there. And this is a convention. You guys who are in the Pacific Northwest or who have, air miles that you can travel, this is the convention that we always set up as being one of the top conventions on the calendar, bar none. It's a fantastic comic book convention. It's a fantastic sci-fi convention. Its treatment of web comics is above and beyond. And it, beyond just being a good time, these guys, this Jim Demonakis and his brother George and their crew, they know how to throw a convention. And we look forward
they
to
really
this
do.
The way a five-year-old looks forward to Christmas. You're talking to four guys that we do, oh gosh, I think I've got so far for this year eight or nine conventions lined up. I don't know how many you're doing, Dave, but we do a lot of conventions. We do them year after year after year. We kind of get a little bit jaded. I've got butterflies in my stomach already. It's Sunday night, and it's a whole week away. I've got butterflies in my stomach about showing up for Emerald City Comic Con.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be great. And one thing that I really – you said it briefly for a second, but I think it's really true, is that Emerald City is – on the West Coast, is becoming one of the most, if not the most, welcoming towards webcomics. All of Half Pixel is going to be there. Penny Arcade, which hometown, is going to be there. Unshelved is going to be there. Unquestionable Content is going to be there. Girls with Slingshots is going to be there. I think Wondermark is going to be there. I forgot to ask Malky if he's going. So it's going to be – it literally is like the last time I looked. Oh, Phil Folio is going to be there. From
yeah,
Girl Genius.
Phil.
And it's just going to be a really good lineup. And as far as the talks, Half Pixel is giving a talk on Sunday morning.
11 o'clock.
And then there's going to be a separate talk that's going to have Robert Koo talking about the business of webcomics, which I'm going to be there. And I'm sure a lot of the Half Pixel guys are going to be there as well.
Yeah.
Hear what he has to say.
Well, we won't be participating in the panel necessarily, but we will be probably there to watch Koo and what he has to say, because –
No, I meant that from an audience perspective.
Yeah.
I want to hear what Koo has to say. So I love this show. There's just something nice about the city of Seattle, too. So the convention could not be better run. It's growing every year, and we are going to be there both days, the 4th and the 5th, this weekend at booth 202.
Yes. Dave,
that said, my good friend, Mr. Geiger, question away. Let's dive into the next one.
All righty. Very good. We are talking about, and this is a great topic. It says, how do I change my comic into what I really want it to be about? And it's sent in by Mad Cat, and his site is direman.com/everwas, EverWas. And he says, I was wondering if you had any advice on how to narrow down exactly what a comic is about and downplay or remove aspects that aren't working anymore. I feel like I started off too unfocused on my story was. Gamer humor, fantasy, romance, slice of life. Eventually I termed it fant-adventure romantic dramedy for adventure fantasy plus romantic comedy plus drama, but it's kind of silly. I feel like I want to deal more with particular aspects of the story and phase out others that aren't as interesting to me. I want to evolve the strip into something different, but I was wondering if there's a graceful way to do it and how readers might react to the change. Or am I worrying too much since I have very few readers as it is and my comic is only a year old? I know you've said the first couple of years are for experimenting and making changes. I want to make sure I'm making the right changes and turning the strip into what I want it to be for the long run. Thank you very much, Mad Cat. So, Dave, help this guy out. How does he change his comic into what he really wants it to be about?
This is an excellent question. I think there are two ways to go about this. One is to realize if you're still in your first year of working on it and you've you're looking at your logs and you're seeing there's not a lot of readers coming. You know, you take out the readership that's clearly mom and dad and cousin Jim, and you realize you only have a few dozen readers. It's not the worst thing in the world to make a complete blank slate change. So that's option one. And Brad might disagree with that, but that's option one. Option two is if you want to maintain some of the foundation that you have or to not shake up the world so dramatically, it's a slow evolutionary process, probably over a year, year and a half, maybe even 2 years, where you introduce new characters and new thematics that you didn't have before, and you slowly start working out the older ones that you want to get rid of. And I think either one of those approaches is valid, depending on how you're feeling about it. But if you're feeling dead as a creator with what you've got currently, a blank slate change might not be the worst thing in the world in terms of reinvigorating you. Just know that you can't do that more than once, probably, I would think.
Yeah, I think the ultimate example of this was Scott Kurtz, and I wish he was here tonight to talk about this, because I really do want to hear about this one of these days. But he did what he called a soft reboot of PvP, and my impression is that's when PvP really took off for the first time, was when he did that soft reboot, and he kind of revamped his character designs, and I think he changed the focus for the first time. It started pulling away from that gamer kind of humor and turned into kind of an office comedy. Although some people would even maybe even tell you that's not even hardly an office comedy, but but you know, I would suggest the soft reboot, and that is to just, you know, start from scratch and tell your readers we're rebooting, and it's very similar to what Chris just did with Starslip Crisis, turning it into Starslip, and he's got a completely new approach with his art, and a new approach with the storyline, and I know his readers have been eating that up, and mainly because I think the change has been fantastic for him, but I think you've got to look at the soft reboot, and the other thing is how many of our strip, I mean. Dave, what he described his strip as a fantasy, romance, adventure, drama, comedy. Do you think that could probably be applied to almost 90% of the web comics out there?
A fantasy, adventure, romantic, comedy, drama it's almost putting the cart before the horse too. It's that. You feel like you have to put the label on the webcomic before the webcomic is created.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
So, yes, I think that you're hitting on something, which is that, you know, if you throw enough words out there, eventually there's a description that fits.
Maybe.
Not only this webcomic, but everybody. But it's also like, do you need it? I mean, if you had to summarize Evil Inc., it's, yes, it's fantasy, yes, there's adventure, yes, there's romance, yes, there's comedy, and yes, there's drama. So what is it missing from there? If I had to do Sheldon, it's occasionally fantasy, it's definitely got some adventure in there occasionally, it's very little on the romance, got a lot of comedy and kind of a little bit of drama. So, I mean, he's named basically the five genres of storytelling as being, you know, evident of what he creates. And I don't know that that helps him much. I think it's better just to write what you want to write and then let the world decide the label to be applied. Unless, you know, there is something to be said for having from a sales and marketing perspective a tap on what your comic is and who it's for. But I think based on the way he writes it, it sounds like it's limiting what he's creating.
Right, and I think that's what my point is. I think you could probably choose... let's say that your comic really is all of those things, and I'm looking at his comic right now, and it's my first experience with it, and I'm seeing people with pointy ears, so I'm seeing, you know, elves and so forth. I'm imagining here. I'm seeing some.
By the way, your description is fantastic. It's like an old man looking at like Lord of the Rings. I'm seeing people with ears. I'm seeing there's some sort of troll creature. I'm not sure what that is. I'm imagining they're on some sort of adventure. I don't know what's happening. I'm lost.
Seeing a name like Eurydice, E-U-R-Y-D-I-C-E, Eurydice. I'm seeing words like half demon. You know, so I think we can pretty much put this in the fantasy realm, nice and comfy. So let's just say that you're going to do a fantasy comic, and you're going to consider it a fantasy comic. And it is perfectly okay for your fantasy comic to have aspects of romance and humor and slice of life and all of those other drama, all of those other things. It's perfectly okay. But if it'll help you get past this point in your progression, you're doing a fantasy comic that does all those other things. Now put it out of your head and start writing good comics. You know what I'm saying? It seems to me like you're all wound up in what your comic is, and all that energy and all that passion should be poured into doing really good comics and not worrying so much where it falls. I think anybody that's going to come to your site is going to classify it as a fantasy comic. All right? No one's going to come to your site and necessarily say, oh, look at that slice of life comic with the people with pointy ears. They're going to say, I'm definitely in a solid fantasy comic realm. And go from there. So you've got the fantasy genre. Don't worry about what else it falls into. It's okay if your fantasy comic also has slice of life humor and drama and romance. The quicker you stop worrying about all that stuff, the quicker you can start worrying about making really good comics.
That is true. So now here's it's a shame we can't have a follow-up question from this guy, because now my thought is, like, I wonder if he wants to move away from fantasy and get into, like, alternate dystopian future robot comic strip. You know what I mean? Like,
well, that's,
because that would be really hard to move from that sort of thing to another.
That goes beyond. That goes beyond reboot. That goes into relaunch. That means if he wants to make that drastic a change, it's time to stop this and start a new one.
Right, but if it's anything else than that, there's no reason why it couldn't be a soft reboot or a slow evolutionary change, because let's say it's your main character that you hate. Well, think of every story that you've ever read where a main-ish character gets lost in the wayside. You know?
Oh gosh, yeah.
If it's a theme or themes that you want to get rid of, that's not necessarily hard to change over time. You can even have an event where something dramatic happens to change that theme. You know what I mean? If let's say, for example, Iron Man was at one point a dad, and then, you know, his daughter dies. Now it's no longer about a superhero dad. It's about a guy who's back to drinking. I don't know. That's a terrible example.
Well, no, it's a good example, because now it's a good example, and you don't even realize why it's good, and I'm going to tell you why. Because you can use a hook like that not only to take care of one plot point that you don't want to include anymore, but you can add another plot point that is much, much more interesting. A superhero who's a dad might not be your thing, but a superhero who's dealing with grieving over his dead daughter, now that's a hook maybe for you. You know what I mean?
I see what you're saying. So you take a disadvantage and make it into advantage from a storyteller perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you kill two birds by one stone, and possibly you can even make it into an event in the sense that you can get a little press out of it, which is not the worst thing in the world in terms of other blog mentions, in terms of other cartoonists that are talking about it. So it's not the worst thing in the world to change a character, to change a theme, to change a storyline. And if you handle it right, it can even be to your advantage, which I think is what Brad was getting at.
Yeah. I think when I launched Evil Incorporated, I definitely wanted it to fall into the superhero genre. And so I can understand where it mainly because I can commiserate with you. I did Greystone Inn, and it didn't fall into any genre. And it lacked focus. So I wanted it to be be able to pull from that genre of people who would enjoy superhero comics, all right? But at the same time, once I kind of pulled it into that framework, I kept doing all of those other kind of jokes that I enjoyed so much doing in Greystone Inn. I do plenty of drama. I do plenty of comedy. I do plenty of slice of life. I can work all of that stuff in and keep it in that superhero framework. And I think as long as you're not all of a sudden, you know, cutting to a middle-aged man and a middle-aged woman sitting at a coffee table, you know, talking incongruously about what's happening, I think your readers are going to float with whatever you put by them, you know.
Right.
And I think, and what I think it comes back to what Dave said in the very beginning too. You've only been doing this for a year. I don't think it's particularly important for you to worry about the readers are going to think, because you've got a long time, you've got a lifetime ahead of you to build up your readership. If you do something right now that loses all of your readers, it might just be because you're making way for all the new readers that are going to come with that new thing that you got hidden up your sleeve. You know,
that's true. That's a good way to look at it. Is that you're actually, it's like clearing underbrush to get to better growth. You know.
That's. I mean, it's hard to believe at this point. You know, because I mean, we were all there. Dave, do you remember clearing the first time that you cleared triple digits in your page views?
I do. Yeah, that's funny.
I mean, honest to God, I think I may have told the story on the podcast, but. I think this was
Brad, the good news is if you have told that story, the Webcomics Weekly has never before repeated a story.
So well, here's let me tell you. I was back. I think it was in a GeoCities site, and I was walking down the street in Baltimore with Scott Kurtz, and there was a motorcycle gang, and they went by and they all shouted, "Hey, you know, no, I had 99 page views." And I came home that night, and I just before bed, checked it at midnight, 99 page views. And I told Carolyn, I said, "Oh my God, honey, I got 99 page views today. It's just a matter of time before I hit 100. I almost hit it today." And I looked at her, and I could see her face just sink. And I kind of studied her for a full 60 seconds, and I said, "You didn't read my strip today, did you?" She says, "No."
And this was in 1997, and she turned to you and she said, "I'm waiting for this strip called XKCD to be created. I'm gonna give it a few more years. I'm still hoping that it'll be created." I love how you're still laughing. I'm just gonna let it go. Let's see how long. I'm going to ride this train as long as it'll go. How long does this chuckle train last? Pretty long, apparently. For those at home who are timing it, we're now in minute two of our marathon laugh. Please, your donations help cure a sickle cell. So please give generously to the Brad Geiger Laughing Marathon. Oh, my God, it's still going. All right, now you're just being ridiculous. You're not laughing seriously anymore. Oh, my God, you are. Oh, my God. You're a cyborg. No one laughs this long.
Oh, God. I swear to God.
You're reaching a magical point in your life, Brad. Can I tell you what that magical point is? It's where your laugh starts to do this at the end of it.
Oh, golly.
You get a cool down period. It's like, you know how modern cars have that cooling fan that turns on when you turn it off? Yeah. Your laugh now has a cooling fan as you slow down. It kicks on even when the engine's turned off.
My God. I swear to God I didn't see that XKCD joke coming.
We did have time for two more questions, but that laugh took up our remaining 20 minutes.
Well, you know what? I think we need to wrap this up because I think we've been at it for about an hour, and I need to catch my breath.
Well, you know what? Before we wrap up, there's one thing I wanted to thank two people. If you remember, for listeners of the podcast, about four or five podcasts ago, I said that as a guy that works on traditional inks on paper, that I wanted resources of all the different types of marks you can make on paper. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but as I was saying to Brad earlier before the show, you know, there's hatching and there's cross-hatching and there's scribbled lines of randomly scribbled lines and there's reticulated lines and there's clusters of lines. But I wanted some sort of visual archive or resource that shows every type of shading and line making that you can make with a pen. And a lot of that is still applicable to a Cintiq, by the way, but just for me it was with working with pen and ink. And two readers emailed in with resources, one of which is a book called The Technical Pen, Pen Strokes in Design and Composition. And I unfortunately have misplaced the original email that directed me to that book. But if you look on page 70 and 71, a really good resource for different types of pen strokes. Once again, the name of the book is The Technical Pen. And then his full last name is Josh, which is J-A-S-C-H, sent in a book that, aside from the DC Guide to Inking, which is really good, and I actually have read that. That is very good. He recommended a book, and I have not checked it out yet, but it looks intriguing. It's called Creating Textures in Pen and Ink with Watercolor. The author on that one, I'm looking on Amazon real quick, but the title again, Creating Textures in Pen and Ink with Watercolor, and the author is, come on, Amazon. I think it's Claudia Nice. Yeah, Claudia Nice. And that one looks good as well. So I just wanted to share that, and with thanks to the two listeners who sent those in, that looks like a great resource.
Yeah.
And then I think we had one more question, but we probably should wrap it up for tonight.
Let's make sure we mention again Emerald City this weekend. Dave, are we going to do another live taping of the podcast at 11 o'clock Sunday?
I don't know if it's going to be recorded, but it's, for all intents and purposes, it's a live. It's all four members of Half Pixel. And the talk is going to be called How to Make Webcomics. So for all intents and purposes, it's a live performance, or however you want to term it, of Webcomics Weekly. So that's at 11 a.m. on Sunday morning at Emerald City Comic Con in room A or B, I don't remember. Another one to look for is the Business of Webcomics with Jeff Jacks, Robert Koo, Danielle Corsetto, and some others. That's going to be on Saturday, I think. And then we are in booth 202 at Emerald City Comic Con on Saturday and Sunday. And you can personally time it in living flesh how long you can get Brad to laugh when you come.
Hey, and now for April, that's going to do it for me for April. I'm not going to be doing another one until, oh gosh, Wizard World Philly in June. You got anything else coming up?
Oh, I do. I'm going to the Los Angeles Festival of Books. I'll be at the Image Comic booth. It's booth 708, and that's on April 25th and 26th at UCLA. It's the big, bright, sunny, open-air festival of books, and all sorts of authors, everybody from Salman Rushdie to Dave Kellett will be there at the LA Festival. Well, I think when you think Salman Rushdie, the next name that springs to mind is Dave Kellett and Sheldon, right? Am I wrong in thinking that?
I'll just tell you yes. Oh, and not to piggyback on that, but the Fables book is being delivered on Tuesday, so unless they printed them all upside down, that will be available at Emerald City.
Heyo! I'm excited about that. That is one of my favorite bits of work that you've ever done. The art in that is beautiful.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited about having it delivered and having it out there in Seattle.
I am excited. So, Brad, I will see you in, 4 days, 5 days in Seattle. Are you flying in on Friday or on Saturday?
I'm flying in Friday. I should be there early afternoon.
Hey, me too. Maybe we should do a reader meetup. Well, we'll talk after the podcast.
Like, maybe just you and me should go get a beer. What do you think of that?
God forbid we just get a beer. All right, maybe we just do that.
Yeah, well, let's talk offline. And
I like how the king of marketing and meeting with readers, you're like, how about we just get a beer?
Yeah, maybe we'll figure something out. You know what?
Don't try to backtrack now. You wanted to get a beer. All right, we're getting a beer now.
All right, man.
All right, have a good night, and you've been listening to Webcomics Weekly.
Webcomics Weekly.
We're out.